videos, and other documents that were found in Afghanistan in 2002 after the defeat of the group's Taliban hosts showed experiments with chemical weapons, proposals for really vast projects like balloons that would carry poisons to rain down upon the enemy, as well as other planning for terrorist acts. The instances we've just discussed of the fusion of religion and ideology, suicide bombings, and the Al-Qaeda network and Islamism clearly show instances where terror and utopia are still dynamic and active as they were in the 20th century, as the 21st century begins. But we want to ask a fundamental question: why then did all of this happen in the 20th century, and what can we learn from it? The 20th century's long and violent record clearly requires explanation, at least in broad outline. And there are paradoxes aplenty here. The indisputable improvements in sciences and the material progress that did so much to improve the lives of ordinary people in the 20th century also opened up new horizons of what seemed possible in other areas of life, in terms of physical change, in terms of changing the landscape and the environment, and decisively including social organization as well. And this was, in a way, a killing paradox, because that optimism about utopian possibilities would then inevitably lead to frustration with the obstacles that stood in the way of realizing those hopes, whether those obstacles were the material limits of one's reality and physical obstacles, whether they were the limits of rationality, or whether, in this case, fatally, whether they were people who stood in the way of realization of ideologies. Again and again, as we've seen, glorious ends, the best of intentions, were used to justify any means, including violence, coercion, and terror. And the shape of modern politics, with its mass nature and popular nature, had a lot to do with this intensity of political confrontation. Modern popular politics, whether in the form of democracy or in the form of totalitarian attempts to orchestrate the masses and set them marching off towards the brave future, all injected new mass forces into the international and domestic political arenas and gave new power and potency to politics. Furthermore, ideas and beliefs played an important role as well, one that's difficult to measure. The decline of traditional religious belief might have left a hunger for meaning in modern man that was to be filled by political faith. Ultimately, the readiness to undertake both utopian experiment and terror, however, depended on what I think is the bottom line of these questions: the views that were held about human nature and what it was and what could be done. Hannah Arendt, in her stunning dissection of the trends of the 20th century, quotes a haunting phrase. And that epigram is that normal people do not know that anything is possible. What she meant by that was that civilization at its best, in some sense, places limits on what human beings can do to human beings. Totalitarian societies eliminate those limits, feeling that the nature of man is something to be manipulated rather than respected. We think back to our discussion of how Chairman Mao had mused on the beauty of human beings precisely because they were blank pages on which one could write whatever one wanted, new and wonderful things. I think that really captures one view. But another view of human nature is captured by those people whom we've discussed who have dissented or have resisted against such regimes, people who were witnesses to the century's violence and despotism. They had a different view of mankind, a different view of human nature, which saw the human being not as something to be manipulated or pushed around in population movements and displacements, but rather as something intrinsically inviolable and durable, something with a human dignity of the individual that should not be violated.